This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. I'm going to talk about agnosticism and Christianity. I'll be talking mostly about agnosticism, and in the end, a bit more about Christianity, because what I would have to say would overlap a lot of the other lecture material that you have on tape here already. And just to begin by saying that agnosticism has existed for an awful lot longer than the word agnosticism has existed. The word was coined or invented by T.H. Huxley in the last century. It comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge, and agnosis, or just simply means not knowing or not knowledge. And this is something that, as I mentioned, I can't possibly go into the sort of history of this in terms of the history of philosophy, but there's been the idea that one cannot know final truth, that one cannot be ever certain about anything, is something that's been around a long, long, long time before the 19th century. But Huxley, coining this word, describing his own attitude, that as he looked into different areas, different explanations of reality, the main thing that he came up with was that one cannot know, one cannot have any kind of certainty. And since then, it's been a word that's associated with all kinds of skepticism, all kinds of people believing that one cannot really know for sure about anything. And it's come up a great deal more recently. I think, for example, there's an awful lot more agnostics around today than there are atheists. It's something that's that there's very much of a rash of in the present time. Now, I'll just examine agnosticism initially, and I'll just mention that there's four kinds of categories of agnosticism. I'm not trying to make a big deal out of these four categories and say these are watertight and altogether able to be separated from each other. And yet, I think there are different kinds of agnosticism. And here, as I talk about this, I'm not going to be dealing with the question of total skepticism. In other words, the question of how can we know anything? How can we know that we're sitting here in the room, for example? I'm not going to be dealing with that kind of question. Or dealing with the questions of the philosophy of science in terms of the certainty of scientific knowledge or non-certainty of scientific knowledge. But I'm just going to zero in on the question of the existence of God, the existence of the God of the Bible. So, mentioning four different kinds of agnosticism. The first that I'll mention here is called, I'm just going to call it the hard line agnostic. The hard line agnostic. And this position is simply that one cannot know God. And one cannot know God as God is in himself. One cannot be certain about any final things in the world at all. Logical positivism has taken this position. It's a position that's largely abandoned by most people who are in chairs of philosophy today, and yet that's very rampant on the streets, the fact that people think you can know things for certain in the areas of science where you can test them, where you can weigh them, measure them, and so on, and experiment with respect to them. But outside of this, beyond this, there can be no certain knowledge at all, or no meaningful knowledge. And beyond that, we must admit total ignorance. That's what I mean by a hard-line agnostic. Someone saying one cannot know truth for certain. The second category I've called a theological agnostic. And in giving this lecture before, I've gotten into all kinds of trouble with this term, but I must say I want to stand by it all the more after the discussions on it. By this I mean I'm really referring to a basically liberal new liberal theological position that's held by liberal theology within the Christian church, which is basically this, that God, we can talk about God, we can talk about, we can use the word God, we can use all the sort of Christian words that surround it, but we can't say anything that's ever true about him. We can't put anything in words that is really true. For example, Tillich, even went so far as to say that we can't say that God exists, because that limits him. God is beyond categories of existence. So we can't even say God exists, because that makes him too small. And yet, at the end of Tillich's life, there was a very revealing contact between he and his fellow Altizer, who was one of the main Death of God theologians. And Altizer came to him very near the end of his life. And Tillich, if any of you studied his thinking at all, has said that God is the ground of being. God isn't a being that you can speak to or something like this that's a separate being, but God is the ground of all being. And he associates this one's experience of the ground of being with some kind of ultimate concern and an experience of the ground of being in his own life. Now, Altizer came to him and said, no, what you experience as the ground of being is really the experience of the absence of God. You think you're experiencing God when you experience the ground of being or when you experience ultimate concern, but what you're actually experiencing is God's absence. What you're actually experiencing is a hole in the universe where God is meant to be but isn't there. And Tillich's wife actually has written that from this point on, from this conversation on, Tillich's health deteriorated and he died very soon after this, and she attributes his death happening when it was to being so disturbed and so upset by this conversation with Altizer. Now, you see, the thing that I'm mentioning here, I'm getting on about here, is that this is theological agnosticism. It's talking about God, using the word God, but God is so far away that it's essentially a matter of definition, whether you say it exists, that he exists or not. It's essentially a juggling of terms, whether you say God exists or not. It's a question of semantics, definition of words. So that's the second category. The first is the hard-line agnostic, who's sure that God cannot be known. The second, the theological agnostic, who will go and talk about God, but say for sure that one can't say anything about him. One can't say anything in words about him. The third category, which is by far the largest numerically in terms of the people that would be involved in it, is the indifferent agnostic. And as I said, this includes the vast majority of people who consider themselves agnostics. The vast majority of people would see themselves as in category one, as hard-line agnostics. But in reality, I think, being honest, they really are in the category of using the word agnosticism as an excuse, essentially, not to have to think. And my main point here is that with the indifferent agnostic, agnosticism simply lends intellectual respectability to sheer apathy. Because the word agnosticism is something we can banter around today, we can throw around, it sounds very respectable, it sounds very sophisticated and profound, but it can function in people's lives as simply something that lends intellectual respectability to the desire to not think, to not really wrestle through these questions at all. And it can be a very, very deceptive and very destructive whole attitude, because it makes someone think that they really are searching, they really are struggling for truth, and yet they really have a basic commitment to not think at all. In this attitude, nothing is proved, and nothing is disproved. Things are just ridiculed. Now, the fourth category is what I'd call the open agnostic. And this is the person who would say, I have not yet seen enough evidence to push me in any one direction. I haven't seen a strong enough case for any position. And therefore, I'm in midair, and I'm willing to look, I'm willing to ask, I'm willing to search. And if truth can be known, I want to know it. If it can't be known, I want to know that too. But it's a basic position of not being committed because you haven't seen sufficient evidence in any one direction, but being willing to look, being willing to search, being willing to be convinced. So there are these four categories, these four different kinds of agnosticism. I'm not trying to, as I said before, make any big thing of the distinction between them, but I think as you talk about agnosticism, it's an absolutely vast, vast subject, and it just carries with it so many different things that it's just helpful to make these distinctions before we begin. Now I'll turn to a criticism of the hard-line agnosticism, and I'm not going to deal with any of the others specifically, because we don't have time, and in a sense, if we deal with the hard-line agnosticism, we deal by implication with the others. But first to say a word about how this is expressed and how people see it, how people see themselves as coming into this kind of an attitude. I think an awful lot of people would hold to a hardline agnostic position without ever having to having read a lot of the philosophers that would that have been very significant in holding this position in the world today, without having read, say, Kant, or more recently having read someone like A.J. Eyre. But this kind of agnosticism is right into the very fabric of 20th century thinking. It's not something that's a high up thing or very far away. It's right down into the very grassroots thinking of you know, not just on in the intellectuals at all, but into people who would definitely consider themselves not intellectuals, but basically approach all these questions with this assumption that finally God in himself can't be known, that final truth is impossible. For example, you can think of the very common notion that all truth is true just on a psychological level. If it's true for you, that means it helps you. And that's wonderful if it's true for you, but that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not it's true for me. Belief in God is true if it helps you with your psychological or sociological problems or whatever, irrespective of whether God actually exists or not. Another way that this whole idea of really hardline agnosticism comes to the surface is in the view that's very prevalent of comparative religions. The basic view that all religions are true and none of them are false. All religions are right and none of them wrong. All are searching after God in their individual ways. Certain cultures look in certain directions, but they're all basically aiming at the same place. You can look at Christ, you can look at Muhammad, you can look at Buddha, you can look at the Hindu avatars. And you're looking at people who've come close to God, who've seen something of God, but none of them has really known God as he is in himself. And no one person or one tradition has ever come to know God as he truly is. Now, what I'm getting at is that all these kinds of attitudes, which are the kinds of things you see just throughout in the whole fabric of thinking today, these basically assume all the assumptions of hardline agnosticism, that final certainty in these areas of God's existence and his nature is impossible. And it's expressed in all kinds of different ways. Now, the basic criticism I have of hardline agnosticism is simply that it's self-destructive. It simply destroys itself. It's much like the computer of science fiction fame that destroys itself when its job is done, or perhaps before its job is done. It's a view that cannot hold logically, but that simply destroys itself. I'll start just giving you an example of what I mean. Something that happened to a professor I once had when he himself was in a philosophy seminar. And his professor started out by saying, and this was the first meeting of the year, of the term, a philosopher who was a pragmatist, and started out saying, the only certainty that we have is that there is no certainty. And he says, this is the assumption that we're going to start with, and this is the thing we're going to, this is the foundation which we're going to proceed from during the whole course. And this professor of mine was sitting in the back, and he raised his hand, and he admits that he wasn't all that humble about his question, but he said, are you certain about that? Are you certain about that? And what was interesting was the response of the professor flew into a rage and threatened to throw him out of class if he would ask such impertinent questions again. You see, this question is not allowed. You know, the only certainty is that there is no certainty. Are you certain about that? You see, there's a desperate kind of thing that you could call philosophically suicidal about that kind of a statement. It really destroys itself. You see, to say you cannot know God, one needs to have just as solid a metaphysical foundation as to say that you can know God for sure. To say that God is unknowable, one has to have just the same kind of basic certainty, or absolute truth that you'd need to say that God is knowable. Because basic agnosticism with certainty denies the possibility of certainty, denies the possibility of knowing absolute truth. And this denial is expressed as an absolute truth. An awful lot of agnosticism comes across in the garb of humility. It comes across with people saying, man's mind is so fallible. Man's mind makes so many mistakes. You can look at the mistakes that men have made, as even very wise men have made. You can look at the horrible mistakes they've made. You can look at how sinful they are. You can look at how small their minds are. And how can man possibly be able to know truth with such a small mind and such a fallible way of knowing? But you see, the more you emphasize this human fallibility, the more the very theory of agnosticism itself comes under fire. For example, in the words of Michael Polanyi, who's written some very helpful things on this, he says that the very theory of agnosticism itself becomes part of a possibly fictitious standard of intellectual integrity. You see what I'm saying? The minute you doubt in this radical way the accuracy and the usefulness of the human mind to perceive truth, then you must also doubt that very theory that you're thinking at the time. And the very theory of agnosticism is just one more, as he words it, fictitious standard of intellectual integrity. So what I'm getting at here, you see, is that the more agnostic you are, the more consistently agnostic you are, the more you must doubt the truth of agnosticism. Now, I've said the same thing in about 17 different ways in the last 2 minutes, and I hope you've gotten basically what I'm trying to get at, that it's with certainty denies certainty and is something that really runs into an irreconcilable contradiction with itself. And so agnosticism, I think, emerges as not just what it says it is, agnosticism, not knowing, but agnosticism emerges as just one other dogmatic belief, one other kind of Gnosticism, one other kind of knowing, simply another kind of dogma. You can see this among many people who've held to an essential agnosticism. For example, you can read in the works of the German philosopher Lessing, as he writes, and it's clear that he really doesn't want to know the truth. He'd really rather not find the truth. I'll just read you a quotation from his writing. He said, "If God held the whole truth in his right hand and in his left the eternal longing for truth, and if he were to bid me to choose, humbly I should choose the left, saying, 'Give me that, Father, for perfect truth is for thee alone.'" You see what he's saying? He said, if I had a choice between knowing the final truth, really knowing truth, on the one hand, and on just endlessly searching for the truth, I'd much rather choose the endless search. I don't really want to know this kind of final truth. And so there's a real commitment, I find, against knowing truth, a real commitment to the search, to the endless kind of search, for fear that once you find the truth, you'll find something static and dead, which, of course, in studying philosophy, this is a legitimate fear. And so the point here is that hardline agnosticism isn't agnosticism at all, but it's real Gnosticism. It's a dogmatic Gnosticism, very sure that no one can be sure. And this is Bertrand Russell's book, Why I Am Not a Christian, was very influential in me becoming a Christian, interestingly enough, because what hit me so much about it was here, and Russell being one of the foremost proponents of agnosticism in the 20th century, I think, certainly one of the most vocal, writing this book, Why I Am Not a Christian. What struck me about the book is I was searching myself without being a Christian, and really as, in many ways, an agnostic. What struck me the most about the book was that here is a guy who's a brilliant man who's breaking his neck to try and get rid of Christianity, who's willing to use all kinds of ham-handed arguments and chop logic just to axe Christianity. In other words, what struck me was that he had an incredible bias against it and was willing to do anything just to get rid of it. And just his hatred of Christianity was one of the things that made me think, well, good grief, what is this thing that he's trying to get rid of so badly? That he hates it so much and it's just nothing. Why doesn't he just leave it alone? But in fact, all the way through his life, he can't leave it alone. And just to say, again, last thing on this critique of hardline agnosticism, even in the area of science, this kind of doubt of everything is a very difficult thing to maintain. For example, again, to use the words of Michael Polanyi as a scientist himself, he's saying that the scientist even can be strictly agnostic only on subjects of which he knows little and cares nothing. Now think about that, that real agnosticism is possible even for the scientist, let alone the theologian, when he knows almost nothing and cares nothing. In other words, what he's saying is that it's impossible to not be committed in one area or another. It's impossible to just maintain neutrality, as if you could just neutrally weigh up all the facts or all the evidence apart from a real personal bias yourself. So he's saying this only, even about the scientists. And of course, this is true about scientific questions, how much more true it is about theological issues. So I think the picture you have in the writings and the lives of people who would hold to agnosticism is just the idea that I would call agnosticism on a leash. Agnosticism on a leash. In other words, it's agnosticism held on a very short cord. Agnosticism that's allowed to fight and bark in one direction, and yet it's held back and held in real check and not allowed to reach into other areas. It's using doubt and extreme skepticism in one area, especially against the God of the Bible, but at the same time holding this doubt back and with a very firm check where it would otherwise look and touch other areas that you don't want to doubt, that you don't want to be equally skeptical of. For example, what so often is never doubted, the agnostic who would doubt certain things with respect to God, but the agnostic would not doubt the validity of doubt as a means of coming to truth, would now not doubt the validity of reason or, say, scientific experimentation as a means of coming to truth. So it's not as if they use doubt on everything, but it's doubt in a very, very restricted direction, doubt not allowed to bark back at them, if you I want to use that illustration. I think we need to see it's kept on a leash in another way as well. Very often people would be agnostics as they work in their study or as they write books, and yet would in their practical lives really deny so much of it, so much of the kind of uncertainty that agnosticism would push one to. For example, you can look at one of the fathers of modern skepticism in the West anyway, which would be David Hume. And he writes about his own work and about his own psychological reaction to his own work, which is fascinating. He says, writing that carelessness and inattention alone can afford us any remedy. Rely entirely on them. I dine, I play a game of backgammon, I converse, I am merry with my friends, and when after 3 or 4 hours' amusement I would return to these speculations, they appear so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find in my heart to enter into them any further. And you see what he's saying. He's saying, sure, I can be skeptical. I can outline a very, very skeptical philosophy, a very sort of agnostic philosophy about the uncertainty of any kind of knowledge. And yet I really can't live in this world. It's so barren. It's so frigid and so sterile and so different from the world I really live in that I simply have to take my mind off it by having fun with my friends. And so what I think you see in many places in the writings of many agnostics is you see a very, very tricky kind of sleight of hand where we're led to believe that they're being very skeptical and very critical and doubting again and again and again in every which area. And yet their doubting is very, very selective and is held on a tight leash. People are apply this criticism and skepticism with respect to God, but not in the things they put in God's place. And next I'll mention the dangers of agnosticism. And here I'm mentioning just more very practical dangers, the dangers in the practical world. And I think there's a very, very ironic thing here, which is the very thing that agnosticism claims to save us from, which is fanaticism. The basic position of agnosticism being you doubt everything, you're only very tentative in your commitment to anything because you can't be sure about or certain about anything. In fact, I feel encourages the very fanaticism that it seeks to discredit and to displace. Example, you can think of the words of Chesterton, which are very, very, very true. He says, when a man stops worshiping God, he does not worship nothing, but worships anything. When a man stops worshiping God, he does not worship nothing, but worships anything. So what I'm getting at is that I think when we have, when we deny the possibility of knowing God in a certain way, what we end up doing is developing some kind of certainty, some comparable level of certainty in something less than God. Here again, you can think of Marxism as and the religious, the deep, deep religious spirit of Marxism and the kind of certainty it would hold on to. And you find at the same time in any culture where there is a very deep lack of certainty, you see a great vulnerability. There's no absolutes that anyone is sure of. There are no absolutes that you can stand on to stand against the pressure, the manipulation, the drift, the consensus that will bounce back very, very fast in any which direction. And one is in a very special way at the mercy of the person who's the best manipulator. I'll just read a brief statement that I must say I find helpful to refer to very often, a statement by a German scientist, Leo Szilard, who wrote in the early 30s, decided in the early 30s to leave Nazi Germany because of what he could see was going to happen there. And I'll just read you his statement as he writes afterwards. I noticed that the Germans always took a utilitarian point of view. They asked, well, suppose I would oppose this, and he means Nazism here, what good would I do? I wouldn't do very much good. I would just lose my influence. Why then should I oppose it? You see, the moral point of view was completely absent or very weak. Every consideration was simply what would be the predictable outcome of my action. And on that basis did I reach the conclusion in 1931 that Hitler would get into power, not because the forces of the Nazi revolution were so strong, but rather because I thought there would be no resistance whatsoever. You see what he's saying? And Germany, which is very much caught in this philosophical and theological agnosticism, nothing certain. All the that had been cut off from the solid theology that had been the backbone of Germany up until that time. The church was no help at all, but the people, as a result, were just sheep to the slaughter for someone with a very powerful ideology, with a powerful message in a time of economic and political crisis. There was nothing to stand up against it. And so what I'm saying is that in a very paradoxical and ironic way, agnosticism that claims to free you from fanaticism, from this kind of going off half-cocked into some strange thing without sufficient evidence, in a way is the very thing that can encourage the exact same thing that it seeks to discourage. People without God never can maintain a tentative commitment to everything. In other words, they can't maintain tentative commitments across the board. They end up making real commitments, real absolute commitments to things less than God. Now, I'm going to turn at the end to discuss where Christianity fits in and just briefly talk about the issues of evidence and Christianity and how the kind of discussion it is when we talk about how do we know Christianity is true, how can we know. Because it is the God of the Bible that's been the special target for the average agnostic. And I think there's all kinds of things we need to take into account here and that are real problematics that arise in our discussion of the evidence for Christianity being true. For example, there's a difference between an argument being persuasive and an argument being logical. An argument that's logical can have very little persuasive value on you. An argument that's very illogical can be very persuasive at the same time. These are two separate things. And what we're talking about, in a way, I think as we talk about trying to figure out whether Christianity is true or not, we have to hold these two things together. Whether something is persuasive to me, and also whether it's logical. I think the argument for Christianity is both. But its persuasive value depends radically on me and on each one of you, as each one of you think about it, in terms of what persuades you, what is able to persuade you. Because as we think about, does God exist, does God not exist, is the Bible true, is it not true, we're not dealing with a question like, is the atom real, A-T-O-M, which for most of us anyway is quite an academic question. It's not something that is going to change our lives tomorrow a great deal if we decide either the atom is there or isn't there for sure. It's something that we can hold, most of us anyway, who aren't involved in the in this kind of science. We can hold the question out at arm's length, and it doesn't deal with how I'm going to feel so much tomorrow and what is the direction of my life. And so even as Polanyi said, that one can't even approach this kind of question in a completely neutral and unbiased way. How much less can we approach the issue of God's reality? And God's the issue of God's reality is different from this in two ways. One, in that it's a far bigger question. In other words, it tells you if God is there or not. It tells you the meaning, or it casts light on the meaning of everything that he's created. In other words, it's not just a question of is a certain thing here or not, is the door there or is it not there, but the existence of God is something that's a much bigger question deals with the issue, does the door have any meaning? Does the door have any place in the universe? Do I have any place? Do you have any place? It's bigger in a second way also, in that depending on what we conclude, whether God is there or not, it really pushes us to a personal commitment, particularly if God is there. So it really means that in our determination of whether God is there or not, it's going to mean a big difference in the direction of our lives, in terms of what direction our lives are committed in. So what I'm trying to get at is to say that there are many ways in which it's illegitimate to just apply scientific criteria for discovery of certain things to theological questions without at the same time realizing the differences. The question of whether God is there or not is a much larger question. Another very complicating factor, again, that the Bible dwells on a great deal is that where very biased judges of the evidence of God's reality. We're biased judges against God. We load the dice against God without realizing it. This is what original sin means, that we try and that we try our darndest to live without God as best we can and turn to God only when all else fails. And we try again and again and again to interpret the universe to make sense without God, to have its point of unity apart from the God of the Bible. Because it says, the Bible says, that man is in a state of moral rebellion against God and doesn't want to face God any more than you want to face a friend that you've wronged in a very radical way. I'm always reminded of a story of my wife's uncle who, when he was in school, he had a motorbike and he was driving along one day and decided not to go to school. It was such a beautiful day. And so spent the day wheeling around the countryside in the motorbike. And in the middle of the afternoon, I guess it was, he came roaring around this corner, and there, up in front of him on the road, were his parents, having run out of petrol in their car. And he was charging along much too fast to be able to turn around and go and pretend he hadn't seen them. But he saw them, and they saw him, and they knew that he saw them. And what he did was what I'm trying to draw attention to here. He simply put his head down and gave it the petrol and went right straight past and pretended that he didn't see them. Well, now, you see, I think the Bible says there's a very comparable picture between the way we relate, between this and the way we relate to God. There's a way in which we've really sinned against him, we've rebelled against him, we don't want to face him. We would really rather go a different way. We'd really rather have a complete different alternative. And so just I mention this because this is a very, very significant fact in our determining whether Christianity is true or not. Do we simply sit here and weigh up evidence in a neutral way as if we didn't have any sort of bias or prejudice at all that we would bring to the whole question? And I think this is very definitely has to be said no. We bring all kinds of biases and prejudices to the whole discussion. And the only way we can ever get anywhere is to recognize these prejudices and to function understanding them. For example, you can see all kinds of illustrations of this. I've talked to people, for example, who all the evidence for Christianity, for whom all the evidence for Christianity counts for absolutely nothing. No matter how much there was, it counts for nothing simply because there's so much evil in the world. In other words, the problem of evil counts so heavily against God's existence, against the possibility of there being a good God, that no amount of evidence can possibly be even in consideration. And it's not even considered to be evidence. Now, this is what I mean by a basic presupposition or bias against it. And it does no good whatever to pile on more evidence for one thing or another. if their basic assumption is this much set against it. You can think of an example within the Scripture itself of the Pharisees in the New Testament, as they would, on the one hand, or out of one side of their mouths, cry out to God, or to Jesus rather, for more evidence. Why don't you tell us who you really are? And yet, the more he showed them about who he was, the more they hated him. And this reaches just the peak of absurdity with the raising of Lazarus, one of the most extraordinary miracles that Jesus did, where he actually raised a man from the dead who'd been dead several days. And you look at their response to this, rather than say, who in the world is this man? This man must be God, must be someone with real power from God at least. What do? They say, we've got to kill Lazarus. We've got to get Lazarus out of the way. And the Bible itself, or Jesus himself, tells us just why they were thinking this way, because he threatened their own authority. They wanted glory from each other, and so they didn't want to believe in anyone who would threaten the glory that they would get from each other. So all I'm trying to say is that they had a bias. They loaded the dice against God, and the more evidence they were given, the more they hated it, and the more they rebelled against it. Now, what I'm basically trying to do is to say that the hardline agnostic's position is untenable because it destroys itself. The indifferent agnostic's position is just dishonest. And that what I would try and do is push people into the category of being an open agnostic. In other words, push people into the category of saying, okay, I haven't seen enough evidence yet, but I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to look. I'm willing to seek. And I think if someone is in this category, one needs to ask a number of questions that are very difficult questions to ask and even harder to answer. But one would be, if Christianity was true and I were to find it to be true, what would I expect to find? Or what would I expect to convince me? What would convince me that it was true if I were to find it to be true? It's a very difficult question to ask with honesty, and a very difficult question to answer, and yet one that needs to push us to really search the Bible and to find out what kind of God this is, what kind of a thing is it that would be true, what kind of thing would I be likely to find if it is true. I think another very important thing is that we pray what's called the agnostic's prayer, which is simply that, God, if you're there, show me. God, if you exist, I want to know, and I want you to show me. And there's all kinds of promises in the Bible that say that because when we're thinking about Christianity being true, it's not just, is a system true, or is a system of or a group of statements true, and we're testing these statements, but we're talking about a God who is a person, a God who really knows us, who created us, and who's more personal even than we are. And so you have a God who can say, promising in Jeremiah 29:13, you will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all your heart. A real challenge. Doesn't make any promises to someone who's just seeking out of curiosity, seeking because they're interested in toying with certain religious ideas or interested in cocktail conversation. But it's a real promise to someone who seeks with all their heart. And so I'll turn lastly to the issue of the evidence for Christianity. And here I'll just skip very, very, very quickly, because I think Oz's tape on evidence, or on, what is it called, verification and Christian truth, deals with these categories much more fully. And I don't want to just repeat some of his material. But I'll just mention the areas of evidence that God presents to us. And here I think the important thing to stress is that if Christianity is true, it's got to check out with all of reality. It's not just that the burden of proof is in one little area, in one narrow area, like, for example, the evidence for the resurrection existing, having happened, or something like this. The evidence of answered prophecy, or one of these things. But if it's true, it's got to check out in the whole of reality as we know it. There's nothing that can be taboo. There's nothing that can be out of court. We've got to be willing to look at everything and see that if Christianity is true, the whole thing is God's world. And as I'm going to just mention at the end, I think the thing that's most convincing to me about Christianity is that everything, as you look at it, the way the Bible sees it, can point together to a certain point of God being the author of it all. So I'm just going to mention the four areas of God's revelation that are mentioned both, I think, in Oz's tape as well as in some of perhaps Schaeffer's tapes on apologetics. The first area would be simply the natural world, the fact that in nature there is real order, there is reliability, science is possible. It's possible to make a rule about the way things normally happen, and sure enough, someone else can put the rule into practice and find that it works. There's also the whole thing that you see so much as you look around you, that the world as we see it now really does point to some intelligence being there that's behind it. I'm not saying this is a proof. This is used, very much misused by people in the Middle Ages as being some kind of a rigid proof, but simply that it points to some intelligence. As we look around us, it really points to an intelligence being there, something higher than just what chance could have thrown up. And here again, I think you need to ask some questions about some of the things that evolution has, the attempts that the evolutionary theory have made to explain things just on the basis of chance become very, very difficult here. The second area is in man himself, not just nature, just not just the natural world, but man himself, in terms of who he is, in terms of his personality, in terms of his creativity, in terms of his rationality, his values, and all these things that are meaningless without a God being there. And as you look at his personality, as you look at the way he behaves, one of the most convincing things to me about Christianity, which is something that I found the Bible alone could explain, with these two sides of man's personality, that he can be so wonderful and yet he can be so horrible. And what you find is a lot of philosophies can explain one side or the other, how man can be very wonderful and noble, but can't cope with the evil that's so deep in man's nature. Or on the other hand, you can find philosophies that will tell you all about what a rat he is, but have no room for a man who can be so incredibly noble and wonderful as we know men can be. And what you see in the Bible is both these things. A man is wonderful because he's in God's image, and he has the stamp of God's nature on him that isn't completely destroyed by the fall. And yet he also is a rat because he's turned away from God, and he's living for himself, and he's trying to only turn to God when he's got no alternative. And you can think of how these things, we can treat them as in a very academic way, in a very far-off way, but these are two sides to man's nature that are very, very real to us. For example, it's easy to say, just in an academic discussion, oh, man is just an animal. Man is no different. And you can explain men on just animal behavior. And yet, when it comes to the crunch, can you allow yourself to be treated as an animal by somebody else? A very, very different story, a very, very different discussion, but it's part of the same argument. You see, it's very easy to toss out, oh yes, we're just animals. But it's a very different discussion to say, I will allow myself to be treated as an animal. Also on the issue of the evil within man, easy to sort of recognize this or to explain it away and say, no, it's really something very light and trivial. And yet just imagine, for example, if each of you had kept a diary over the last week, and it kept a diary not just of the things that you'd done, but of the things that you'd thought. So you had in this book everything that you'd thought for the last week. And suppose you had your name, your address, and so on in this book, and that just about an hour ago you'd lost it. Now I would suggest that there'd be nobody here in this room now. You'd all be out madly searching for it, desperately afraid that someone would find it and read it. Now you see the point. It's simply that we have things going on inside ourselves that are horrible, thoughts that are horrible, things we actually do that are horrible, and we don't want to let people see, and we want to protect them. And there's something that's far below our image of ourselves. You see, I think we have these two things that we can explain away in an academic discussion, but when it comes to the real crunch, these things are very real to us and are very important to us. So in this second area I've mentioned, the first thing I've mentioned is the way God shows himself in the order that's there in nature. And the second thing is in man, is in the nature of man, both his personality and the way he expresses his personality. And then to skip on very, very quickly, the third area is simply the continuity of the Scripture, the whole Bible, the Bible as itself. The themes that carry on through the Bible, the way the whole thing is so incredibly beautifully related together, though it's written by many, many, many different people across thousands of years. The way prophecy is fulfilled in the Bible in extraordinary ways that just defy any attempt to put the label of coincidence on them. The way archaeology, so much of the archaeological discovery supports the actual biblical accounts. The way constantly the Bible is talking about a very tough kind of truth, about something that's true, not just because it helps me psychologically, but because it really works, it really bears out in the tough world that we live in. And you could go on in a lot of ways in this direction. But the fourth thing I'll mention here is the fourth area of God's self-revelation, His self-disclosure to us, is in the person of Jesus Christ. Because this, it's in Jesus Christ, the claim of the Bible is that in Christ, God entered space and time. Now, this is, you see, the agnostics' big bellyache about Christianity is that the whole thing is so airy-fairy and up in the air and doesn't enter into this area where science can determine anything and can discover anything and deal with any of these questions. And yet, what the whole claim of the New Testament is that God has entered space and time and made huge claims about Himself, claimed to be God, claimed to be the Savior of all men. And something very different from what would be possible. Let me start again. The way people would usually describe Christ today, which is as a good man or an interesting prophet, this would have been an untenable thing to hold in the first century, because he was so blatant in terms of what he claimed for himself that you would have to either believe it or say he's a quack and a charlatan and someone who's radically deceiving people. There was no room. He didn't leave any room for people saying, oh, he's a good man, and sort of pat him on the head, damning him with faint praise. But Jesus pushed people to say there is no option between saying he's God or he's just a fraud. And because you can see people all the way through his ministry, he polarizes every situation that he's in. And he pushes people very radically, either for him or against him. And you think, and in talking about Jesus, I think as well, the whole thing of his personality, the power of his personality, and the goodness of his personality that comes through in such an extraordinary way. The amazing power of just who he was and how he acted and how he behaved and the things he said. Extraordinary that in a book that's as uncomplimentary about its heroes as the Bible is, and you can think about this, the uniqueness of the Bible in terms of the literature of the world, where all the heroes of the Bible are exposed. For example, Abraham, the Bible doesn't go without saying, telling all about Abraham's lies. It exalts Moses as a hero, but doesn't go without saying that Moses murdered a man and that Moses forever dithered around, wondering whether to follow God or not. It showed David as a hero as well, but didn't go without showing that David was an adulterer and arranged for murder as well. So you have a book, the Bible, that's incredibly brutal about and uncomplimentary about its heroes, about the best men that it talks about. And the same Bible, the same book about Jesus said he was without sin. He was without sin. He knew no sin. Extraordinary of a book that's so brutally realistic and in this way is set off very radically from all the religious literature of the time and before and of the time after as well. So this extraordinary claim that he was a perfect man, as well as the evidence for example, his miracles and the resurrection, that where we get into such difficulties in trying to explain them in another way. Well, here again, I don't want to go into this area anymore because it's been dealt with so much in other ways and in other places. But as I started out saying, one of the most helpful ways to look at it is not just to put all the weight in one area or all the weight in another area, but it's to say, look at the whole thing together and be honest with yourself and really look to see what the whole blinking thing points toward. As you read the Bible, as you study who God says He is, how He reacts, as you study Jesus and His life, and as you live in the world that we're all living in. And as I've tried to show, that hardline agnosticism is something that really is untenable if we are to take it seriously. That indifferent agnosticism is simply dishonest, and we're just conning ourselves, and we of all people are the losers. And so really push toward a position of open agnosticism, at least, of saying, okay, I'm willing to look, I'm willing to be convinced if there's something there. And yet I think the big danger today for people is this thing I've called indifferent agnosticism. The big danger is to think that you really have wrestled with the thing and have pursued it and simply determined that one can't know truth, when all you really decided to do is you've gotten sick of asking the question, you've gotten sick of looking, or, as is very often the case, you've gotten scared, as this happened to me myself, actually. I got scared that Christianity might be true. And as the illustration C.S. Lewis gives, which is so fine, of our investigation of Christianity being much like children playing in the attic, playing cops and robbers fearlessly in the attic and rushing around and doing all kinds of brave and courageous deeds until they hear a real footstep in the hall outside, and suddenly they freeze and the game has changed completely. Well, in the same way, you see, our investigation of Christian truth can be the same thing. We can have a great time at it while it's off at arm's length. But very often, the minute we get a hint that it really might be true, that this God, who's a real person, will meet us individually, face to face, we can back away and we can be scared that this God will demand more of us than we're willing to give, and will want more of our life than we're prepared to let him have. But I just close then saying that this God shows himself in all these areas and also welcomes us to test him, to test what he's said and what he's done, what welcomes us to really look and really search, and has promised us that he'd show himself if we search for him with all our hearts.